You're listening to This Way Up, a podcast from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. We are a global NGO with research experts in more than 20 countries, pushing for greater human rights accountability in business. Our second series is hosted by Elizabeth Dykstra McCarthy, a former member of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre Natural Resources team, who is now consulting on climate action and environmental issues around the world. Along with several special guests, she'll delve into the social impact of the transition minerals boom, the pitfalls of futuristic methods of mineral extraction, and the capacity of communities to hold companies accountable for abuse, all in search of answers to the question, what is the true cost of clean energy?
The climate crisis is upon us. With it comes the urgent need to decarbonize and transform our economies from those reliant on fossil fuels to greener, cleaner sources of energy. Governments and companies around the world and droves of concerned citizens are driving this transition forward for the good of the planet, its people, and its creatures. But not all people will benefit equally. As the renewable energy transition accelerates, what will the challenges be? Who might the hidden victims be? And what can we do now to make this transition as just as possible?
I would like to remind us all that we have 98 months to halve global emissions. The difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees is a death sentence for us.
Global warming is upon us, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse unless we do something about it.
Along with Boris Johnson, launched a transnational grid initiative called One Sun, One World, One Grid on the sidelines of the UN Climate Conference to transport solar power to different countries under its green grid initiative.
Is producing almost half of the country's electricity from the sun by 2050.
To reach 30% zero emission truck and bus sales by 2030, nations today are committing to bring transport emissions in line with Paris Agreement ambition.
A mere 20 years ago, the idea that the oil age might be coming to an end would have been inconceivable. Today, that reality still seems a little presumptive, but it is one under discussion. COP26, the climate negotiations conference, brought that forward inch by inch, as country after country committed to end its use of coal power and the automotive industry lined up to consign the combustion engine to history. Renewable energy has stolen the show. Solar PV is now the cheapest form of energy, beating all fossil fuels, including gas. Solar and wind are deployable at scale in most countries in the world, finally ending many countries' reliance on costly fuel imports. The side benefits are obvious too, with less air, water, and soil pollution, and the many health impacts those cause. And that is before we even tackle the burning need to reduce carbon emissions. According to the International Energy Agency, this year, in 2021, renewable energy is set to break another growth record and will hit 30% of the world's energy mix. Using BP statistics themselves, in 2000, solar and wind energy made up only 0.07% of the world's energy mix. Now, that's almost 3% of total power generation from those two sources alone. Sure, that is still only 3%, but a rapid growth over the past two decades, and a growth that is only set to accelerate. With all the beauty of hindsight, it is hard to fully appreciate how swiftly and how extensively the landscape has shifted. And that shift is only accelerating. According to Bloomberg New Energy Finance, wind and solar energy together are expected to make up close to 50% of our global energy mix by 2050. But, of course, nothing comes without a cost. These technologies are cleaner and greener. Wind and solar generate no greenhouse gases in the making of their energy, reducing the world's carbon footprint and pollution of our natural resources and ecosystems. But these technologies still need to be made, and the materials that go into them still need to be sourced. Whilst this appears a comparatively smaller cost, the ramp-up has been felt in the countries where these minerals are produced, and the process is far from carbon-free. Low-carbon technologies, particularly solar PV, wind and geothermal, aren't much more mineral-intensive relative to fossil fuel technologies. Research published in 2020 found that about 3,000 solar panels are needed for just 1 megawatt of solar PV. A 200-megawatt solar PV project could thus be as big as 550 American football fields. This takes resources, labor, and land. Who will be the ones to provide it? Will they also stand to benefit from all the changes we make as we transition the world economy? And if not, what can we do about it?
Mining is one of the most destructive practices on Earth. Around the world, mining is threatening people's homes and destroying ecosystems.
The extractive sector as a whole, not just transition minerals, has quite a dismal reputation for human rights and the human rights record of the sector as a whole. And this is from environmental risks through to, you know, community and social impacts, through to governance, you know, around corruption and tax avoidance. And across the entire value chain of the extractive sector, there has been a lot of work from communities and civil society to try to address these problems.
This is Jessie Cato, manager of the Natural Resources Program at the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. She works at the nexus of human rights in extractive industries, particularly those on transition minerals and renewable energy implementation. Transition minerals are those minerals needed for renewable energy technologies and the renewable energy transition. There's a huge range of those, but for Jessie and her team, that means six specific minerals.
The reason we picked these six, and this is, you know, manganese, nickel, lithium, zinc, copper, and cobalt, is because of the crucial part that they play in certain technologies.
Needs vary. Aluminium and copper are core components for wind turbines, solar PV, and batteries. Cobalt, lithium, nickel, and manganese for lithium-ion dominant battery technologies, and less discussed but still present, neodymium and dysprosium for wind turbines and batteries too.
Copper, for example, can be a bit confusing to people as a transition mineral because it's always been a part of our mineral needs. It plays a big role in things vastly beyond energy transition. You know, it goes into our homes and our pipes and our money, and, you know, it's been something that is a part of our societies for a really long time. But it is also a really critical part, particularly for electric vehicles and battery storage. And competing needs between existing social needs for copper, as opposed to the increase that we need for renewable energy technologies and meeting the demand of companies and consumers for those technologies, is one of the things that's causing the significant ramp up in both exploration and production.
Copper is an incredible conductor, which makes it vital for technologies like wind turbines, converting the kinetic energy of wind into electricity and transmitted through copper cables. The average wind turbine needs around 4 tons of copper each. But copper has also been one of the largest sources of human rights allegations, according to the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. This is one of the fundamental tensions in the mining of transition minerals.
This is a sector that still faces an enormous amount of salient risks for companies, but companies that don't necessarily address those risks and are operating in a way that is causing significant amounts of environmental harm, but also significant amounts of community conflict. Why that's become an important part of the conversation for the energy transition is because some of these minerals, not all of them, but a lot of them, are needed to make the technologies that we need to shift away from fossil fuels and that we need to power our world in a clean and green way. What that has meant, though, in practice is a significant escalation in extraction rather than that going hand in hand with the de-escalation of fossil fuels. We're not seeing that happen at the same time. We're just seeing a ramp up in mining.
So what issues are we talking about exactly?
So the top three issues we see in the Transition Minerals Tracker water access and water rights, environmental damages, and then land rights.
We're going to dig into all those issues over the next few episodes, but today we'll be sticking with the social impacts, such as child labour, modern slavery, and violence. This isn't to argue that it's the production of wind turbines alone that's producing human rights violations. These extractive projects were not starting from a blank slate and had been mined for decades, rarely without consequences. It does mean, however, that the process of equipping the world for climate change comes at the cost of some communities' rights and resources, and thus their climate resilience.
So lithium, cobalt, copper, nickel are in communities that have already faced decades of extraction and are quite often already on the front lines of climate effects now, particularly around water salinity and water access. And so the increase in mineral extraction and production is a necessary part of meeting our goals under the Paris Agreement, moving towards a net zero carbon economy. But right now is exacerbating some of those problems that climate change is causing, particularly around water, but also community conflict, where these are communities that are exhausted in some ways by company extraction, by company engagement. Their resources have already been depleted. And similarly, these are communities that are often well placed for renewable energy projects. So there's pressure points coming in from numerous spaces.
This is one of the thousands of unregulated, unmonitored mines in the DRC. It's crawling with children working like modern day slaves. A 12-hour long day of punishing work may earn them the equivalent of a pound. Although one of the poorest countries on earth, DRC is rich in minerals.
Perhaps the poster child for the human rights challenges of the renewable energy transition is the mining of cobalt in the Congo. Some 60% of the world cobalt supply comes from the DRC, and it's a critical element in battery technology, upon which renewable energy technologies, from battery storage to electric cars, rely. For years, however, the cobalt supply chain has been mired in controversy. A 2016 report published by Amnesty International and AfriWatch documented how potentially tens of thousands of children were working in these mines, as well as the hazardous working conditions, from respiratory impacts to tunnel collapses.
Child labor was a key problem in mining, ethanol mining exploitation.
Speaking now is Emmanuel Mpala Nkumba, director of a DRC-based nonprofit, AfriWatch. He and his organization work alongside marginalized communities to tackle issues of discrimination, particularly those in the natural resources and water sectors. The report he worked on with Amnesty interviewed children who were absent from school to work in the mine for up to 12-hour days, year-round, without safety equipment, and were beaten by the security guards employed by mining companies. UNICEF data shows that some 40,000 children work in mines in the country's southeast, mostly digging for cobalt, and in the more northern Kivu provinces, where they toil in coltan mines, often run by militia groups. However, he and other scholars, including the UNICEF staff, have been quick to point out that although the idea of children working in mines is distasteful to a Western audience, for households in poverty, it might be the only thing standing between them and destitution. Children often worked in mines because their parents couldn't leave them behind, or to earn money for school fees. It is a result of wider issues of poverty, not a standalone human rights issue. This doesn't diminish the danger, of course, but it might make us think differently about how we tackle the problem.
But we have cases of communities resettlement. The company are removing them from their land without fair compensations, without their consent, fair consultations. As a human rights organization, what we do is to organize communities to help them to fight, to defend their rights against big companies when the case of resettlement occur without fair compensation, without any consultations, consent. Our work is to help them to go to court, for instance, or to get fair compensation from companies.
A further AfriWatch report, Cobalt Blues, detailed how mining companies across the DRC have expropriated land that communities had lived and relied upon. Tenke Fungurume in the Katanga province of the DRC is one of the world's largest copper and cobalt mining deposits. Over 400 households left their homes and agricultural lands for the construction of that mine. For 2 years, they were forced to live in tents, and those who were compensated received around $200 to make up for their loss of income, simply not commensurate with the long-term loss of livelihoods that they sustained. When relocated, the communities often complained that the new locations lack fertile land, access to water, infrastructure, and electricity.
The second one is the problem of what I can call modern slavery. So you can see people are working a lot. Sometimes they are spending 2 days, 3 days, or a week working underground to get minerals. But when they sell the minerals, they don't get enough to feed their families. Why? Because the market is not well organized. And because the state is not playing a good role to protect them. Why? Because international initiatives don't fit the problem they have.
For Emmanuel and his campaign, part of the harm lies not merely with the mining companies themselves, but the governments and international communities who allow this to happen, or apply solutions which either fail to have an effect or are actively counterproductive. The Congolese government, rather than cracking down on the abuses committed in the sector, is actively entangled in the murky world of cobalt mining. The Sycamines mine, which contains almost 650,000 tons of cobalt, or 10 years of the world's annual production, was a $6.2 million deal when it was made in 2008. It was also part of the business empire of Zoe Kabila, the younger brother of the at-the-time Congolese president. Of course, that isn't the only form of corruption. Some are much more run-of-the-mill.
Some taxes are illegal, so they are paying a lot of money. It's illegal. And if you try to see, this money is not reaching the budget, the provincial budget or national budget.
When state infrastructure is so weak, it's easy to see how fictional taxes are applied to small artisanal miners. By the same token, taxes which are owed to the government often aren't paid. In that Sycamines deal, the largest single investment in Congolese history, taxes were exempt until the infrastructure and mining loans were fully repaid. So the Congolese most affected by these mines would never benefit from the revenues accrued from it.
That's about corruption. And of course, we are fighting it and we are asking the government to publish, to release contracts so we can understand cases of corruption. And also we are asking the justice to open cases against people who are accused to be involved in the cases of corruption.
Corruption percolates down the business chain. Multiple sources describe the challenges of seeking justice in the DRC and the dangerous business of interacting with mining companies, the local government, and local judiciary. Of course, before we start scapegoating cobalt, this issue goes far beyond one mineral.
For us as Congolese, we don't understand why people are just talking about cobalt without talking about copper. Because in Congo, you can't mine cobalt without copper.
Some civil rights activist groups or academics or policymakers have suggested that, given the egregious human rights record of certain minerals, of which often the most notorious is cobalt in the DRC, companies should seek to minimize their usage of these materials or cut them out altogether. Let's go back to Jesse Kato to discuss why some of these solutions, as Emmanuel described, simply don't work the way that you'd imagine.
The issue with that line of thinking is that it proposes that the problem is commodity specific or it is country specific or location specific. And what we know is that human rights abuses are not ingrained within certain communities or ingrained within some extraction method or commodity. They are part of business practices. So wherever you have extraction and communities, you are likely to find some human rights abuses because of the way that the extractive sector operates and how it operates with environments and with communities.
So, for example, there are currently many allegations surrounding the mining of lithium in South America, home to the lithium triangle in Chile, Argentina, and Bolivia. A company could simply move its lithium source from there to Australia and would have technically solved a salient human rights risk. But firstly, that simply isn't sustainable from a supply perspective. For one thing, the lithium back in Bolivia will still be mined, but simply by a different company, one which may not be as large or as human rights conscious and therefore unable or unwilling to tackle the human rights issues.
And therefore you've not done anything to fix the governance issues, you just moved out of there and so they can operate as they like.
Extractive companies can operate regionally, but when we trade globally, these geographic delineations have little impact on the wider scale human rights issues.
There are companies, the larger companies, that do have a responsibility for setting benchmarks of operation and standards, and shifting away from those does not help either the community or the country or the sector as a whole. You still then have human rights risks and human rights violations within the supply chain of renewable energy technology.
Plus, we don't have the agility in the global supply chain to be able to make moves away from specific commodities or specific countries in that manner. Take the scandal surrounding solar panels, for example. Nearly half of all global supply of solar panels are from one province in China, Xinjiang alone.
The issues that occurred in Xinjiang were around allegedly forced labor and modern slavery allegations. And the reason why that's an issue is because polysilicon, which is a major component of solar panels, comes predominantly from that region. And so for solar companies globally to stop using polysilicon from Xinjiang within their production would essentially shut down the solar panel industry. what that has meant is that you can't actually shift away from the human rights risks and abuses. There is nowhere to shift to. The renewable energy sector has seen that specifically with polysilicon. But as our technology gets more advanced and shifts, this is really just an early warning sign.
What is more, we simply don't have the time. Research published by the World Economic Forum in 2020 noted that many experts estimate it will take around 10 years for battery technology to evolve that greatly reduces or entirely eliminates cobalt. That is hardly a solution for the communities now, or the rest of the planet.
As we've seen with Xinjiang, there is no way we can move with the pace or the speed that we need to. We don't have another solution in terms of a mineral solution to this issue at the moment. And we're in a region, change is not going to come from external Western pressure. So what do we do? And the problem with that is that a lot of people don't know what to do.
Secondly, as Jesse points out, this is a particularly short-sighted move from a full energy transition perspective.
There are going to be shifts in technology. And we do know that the technologies that we're using today may not have the same mineral demands in 10, 20, 30 years. There is a move to try to decrease the dependence on cobalt, for example.
Moreover, moving from one mineral to another doesn't solve the problem simply because the commodity has shifted. We know that, for example, the majority of human rights allegations in the extractive sectors for transition minerals are against copper mines. This cannot be because copper is intrinsically more damaging either environmentally or socially than nickel or zinc, but rather due to the magnitude and duration for which copper has been mined. These allegations might scale down were copper production to be reduced, but scale up for the commodities which are used instead.
Just because we don't need as much cobalt in batteries as we may have needed doesn't mean we're going to stop needing cobalt. So to summarize, the problem with that kind of argument is that it looks to being able to solve human rights as a problem that occurs at the site, and not a problem that occurs because of the business model and the ways of operating. And I think it is largely a way to shift responsibility, again, from companies onto communities or governments or individuals, and not taking responsibility for how extraction drives, causes, exacerbates different human rights abuses, and not then building that into the governance system of the sector as a whole.
And lastly, to go back to Emmanuel's point, you can't have one commodity without the other. Whilst the allegations around cobalt are wide-ranging, serious and unacceptable, there has been substantial more attention awarded the cobalt supply chain in comparison to other less hot-topic commodities. What we learn from the copper industry, for example, is that as all of these minerals expand production, whether nickel or lithium or zinc, human rights abuses will grow accordingly. In this way, the lesson from copper production is that of an early transition mineral.
If we look within the tracker at the mine or the project that has the most amount of violations recorded against it, it is the Los Bambas project in Peru, and that is one of the largest copper mines in the world. These allegations from the mine relate to water access, environmental harm, community consent, use of security forces, labor violations, crackdowns on right to freedom of protest. It really runs the whole gamut. This project does not have the consent of the community and the surrounding communities to operate. And even outside of that, does not seem to have proper due diligence to operate around its environmental and labor rights. What that means, both for a community side and for the company side, is that it's routinely shut down because they can't operate the mine either due to strikes or due to violence through protests. And I think what we're going to see, and it won't just be unique to copper, but I think because of the way that copper has already been extracted in some communities, it is going to be, I think, more of a breaking point for some.
So we can't just cut it out. Instead, many policymakers and NGOs have turned to how the mines are operated and by whom. Large scale or small scale, these mines are plagued with violence, from that perpetrated by private security forces to the arming of rebel groups and the fueling of civil war.
Over the past year, there have been at least 80 fatalities in these mines. But we also spoke to people who said that many accidents aren't reported, and bodies are just left buried underground.
They don't have any basic tools, safety equipment, or protective clothing.
The reputation around artisanal small-scale mines, or ASM, is pretty dire. ASM can take several forms. Traditionally, it has been the thorn in the side of the larger, established mining companies, as artisanal miners will mine illegally, without due rights to the mines, often covertly entering and extracting ore or operating on the fringes of official mining concessions. Sometimes they are tolerated by the mine owners, sometimes not. The work is clandestine, so with little oversight and no health and safety protocols at all. This makes the artisanal miners incredibly vulnerable and the work incredibly risky. But it also offers a stable form of income to huge swathes of the surrounding communities of these mines. Sometimes, of course, they are accepted by large-scale mining operations and contribute to mine production. But hold that thought, as we'll be coming back to it later. Approximately 70% of the world's cobalt supply comes from the DRC, where 15 to 30% or so comes from ASM. It is true that human rights issues are more pronounced in ASM work, but it is also the sole form of employment for many in destitute communities. Emmanuel Impala, the director of AfroWatch we just spoke to, has also authored multiple reports on the dangers of these mines, including on how to reduce conflicts between mining companies and artisanal miners. He too speaks to the challenges of ASM.
When the mining companies, the large mining companies, try to remove artisanal miners from their concession, then you will see sometimes the police or the army, they are committing human rights violations.
The mining concessions are all owned by industrial mining companies who possess exploration or exploitation licenses. This means that these areas cannot be lawfully used for artisanal mining. However, due to the lack of official artisanal mining zones at all, individuals, often outsiders to local communities, invade mining sites that belong to companies. These intrusions occur with or without the consent of these companies, and can be made possible by security guards taking bribes and local and national officials who set up informal marketplaces for these minerals to be sold in return for taxes. Formally, the companies and local governments may or may not permit this behavior, but whether or not they do, the crackdowns come regardless.
They are beating at our miners, they are shooting on them. This kind of conflict led to human rights violations, because the army can intervene, the police, and they are committing human rights violations.
Sometimes the crackdowns are from the private security forces against the artisanal miners. Sometimes it can come at the cost of innocent bystanders, such as in a 2014 case reported on by RAID, where a community member who encountered security forces on patrol died as a result of his injuries. Deploying soldiers to clear tens of thousands of illegal informal miners from mining concessions is a new approach by the authorities in the DRC, who have wrestled with the problem for decades. In August 2019, the Congolese army was deployed against these artisanal miners at Glencore's KCC, where the military used live bullets. One man was killed. At Tenke Fungurume, the use of the military in response to artisanal miners entering the concession led to the deaths of two miners and the destructions of many homes. During the destruction, the soldiers set fire to a house with a child still inside. Luckily, she escaped, but the danger is clear.
Because the artisanal miners don't have the space where they can mine, it's a huge problem. And if we don't sort out that problem, and then we'll still talking about human rights violations from police, from the army, against artisanal miners who are going to cheat minerals from big concessions, which belong to large mining companies.
Emmanuel's point is a fundamental one. Mining corporations do have a legal right to this land, and they shouldn't be responsible for health and safety or child labour of workers illegally on their concessions. And the dangers of ASM being laid at the door of these mining companies pushes them to drive them off their land. But if these workers have not been given space for legal mining, they have little choice. Simply shutting down the ASM sector would leave these people without jobs, and these households without incomes.
If we don't provide artisanal mining space where cooperatives can work with artisanal miners, then we will continue to have human rights violations in terms of modern slavery, in terms of the army, the police beating artisanal miners or killing them. We have cases where they are killed because they are going to cheat minerals from big concessions.
it will be impossible to slow the demand of workers for the artisanal mining sector. This is a secure source of household income for often incredibly poor surrounding areas. And why should they be shut down? In many of these communities, they were living on and working on the land before large multinational companies bought it off the government and arrived to exploit the mineral reserves. Whilst ASM is more dangerous, it doesn't follow that it should be shut down in favour of official mining operations. Instead, Emmanuel is suggesting formalising the ASM sector, acknowledging the dangers and seeking to address those.
So what we are asking is that instead of having a lot of international initiatives, we need a strong help coming for cooperatives to have their own mining space.
Academic research published as recently as 2021 examined two pilot programs for responsible sourcing of cobalt in the DRC. They concluded that more needed to be done to support the formalization of the artisanal mining sector through initiatives like cooperatives. These could ensure the representation of miners' labor rights, from health and child labor to women's representation and fair pricing. Cooperatives would empower miners to negotiate their own prices and demand fairer and more transparent processes. This would have endless knock-on effects.
Because that will allow them to get credit from the bank. And if they have credit from the bank, they can buy tractors. With these tractors, they can organize well the space. They can formalize the space where they are working.
Formalizing the sector would allow workers to get access to proper equipment, reducing the number of on-site accidents.
And also to organize the market itself, because the market is not fair at this point. It's the buyers who is determining the price, the quality of minerals, and everything. It should be the buyers and the sellers will determine the quality of minerals and even the price, because now is the buyers who is doing everything, so, and is fixing everything. That is not in the advantage of actual miners. So we are asking the state to organize that market and to have lab, independent lab, to determine the quality of minerals and also the official services to fix the price. So that will help artisanal miners to get enough money from their work.
Emmanuel is arguing that a local cooperative should be able to defend the rights of its members, the diggers, by negotiating the best prices for minerals and preventing the quality and weight of the minerals from being manipulated by the buyer. The ability to negotiate prices would increase income and thus might begin to tackle the desperate poverty of the region. A cooperative and legal standing would give them longer-term security of livelihoods. And lastly, as Emmanuel describes, it would give artisanal miners access to independent tests of the quality of the minerals they trade, so that they don't simply have to accept the determination of mining companies and the prices they set. And lastly, of course, it would bring an end to the extreme violence perpetrated against civilians by private security forces and more. As demand for cobalt has grown, so have the repressive tactics against artisanal miners. So has the preponderance of labor abuses. Honing in on the cobalt sector in the Congo, from its now infamous history of child labor, state-sponsored corruption, and violence towards artisanal miners, lends itself to the conclusion that this is all too thorny an issue, and cutting cobalt, or the Congo, out of the supply chain might be the only solution. For that reason, the warnings earlier should serve to remind us not only that this isn't feasible, but that policies like these wouldn't solve any of the issues we have discussed. These human rights violations are all symptoms of a more endemic disease. To demonstrate that, in our next episode, we'll be on the other side of the world, looking at how copper mining has driven and prolonged war itself.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To stay up to date with all the latest news from us, you can follow us on Twitter at BHRRC or search for Business and Human Rights Resource Centre on LinkedIn. Be sure to subscribe to This Way Up wherever you get your podcasts. Keep tuning in, and if you like what you hear, share with your networks.